Thanks, Lawrence. Now, the outline of my talk today is effectively what is forensic soil science, and I emphasise why use soil science, and why do we not use earth forensics, or geoforensics, or perhaps even archaeological forensics. So I'll explain that in a little while. Why is soil a powerful contact trace? And the main emphasis of my talk today is going to be why did we develop broad guidelines for conducting soil forensic investigations? And in these guidelines, I'm going to emphasise the soil collection and sampling, soil characterisation and evaluation in four stages. And I won't go into any detail, but in my next slide, I'll explain why we actually have guidelines included there for expert witnesses. Now, to illustrate this, what I'll be doing is using a number of the case studies that our centre, the Centre for Australian Forensic Soil Science, has done over the past nearly 10 years. But I'm going to use one case in particular because I believe it emphasises a lot of what I'm wanting to emphasise, that's the collection of samples, the stages, and so on. And it's to do with a case that was a kidnapping and rape of a 9-year-old girl, and I'll use that as the main example in the discussion, and then I'll give some conclusions. Now, I'm starting off with this slide, effectively, because what separates soil science from forensic soil science is the fact that you've got a court involved or a legal system involved. And the forensic scientists that are here today understand this perfectly. The problem is that soil scientists rarely, if ever, get to stand in a witness box. And that really is the scary part of doing this sort of work. Now, in Australia, the courts are slightly different. The witness box is there, and you face the jury. It's a bit more logical, so you're looking across the judge and you've been cross-examined. So I want you to really bear that in mind, because that really is the important part of what I'll be saying for the rest of today. So then, what is soil science? It's basically the study of natural, and I'll emphasise anthropogenic bodies in landscapes, or soils in landscapes, that are basically managed by either agricultural production, environmental waste, or in fact construction or urban environments. So really, forensic soil science, putting the two terms together, is basically the study of soil science that involves a lot of these different disciplines, which is effectively soil morphology, or what is commonly called in soil science as pedology, mapping, spatial work, mineralogy, chemistry, geophysics, biology, and molecular biology. And of course, the main purpose of using these different disciplines is to answer these legal questions, problems, and hypotheses. And to do this, the best way of doing it is to, in fact, study soils from a range of scales. So effectively from the landscape or broad scale, in fact almost the global scale, we need to understand soils around the world in terms of maps, global maps, to state maps, to local maps, and all the way down through localised areas right down to the molecular level, both from a mineralogical point of view and from a biological point of view. It's important to bear that in mind. So really, if you want to get involved in doing forensic soil science, it's both very challenging and often very stressful. And I say stressful because basically you're crossing disciplines and you're having to work with the justice system. So that ends up as being quite often pretty dusty sorts of work you do, but that's the way it is. Now, we need, as soil scientists, to broaden our horizons to, in fact, integrate with other forensic disciplines, and I'd say they inseparably linked to geoforensics, archaeological forensics, and certainly environmental forensics. We're very fortunate today to have quite a few very key players around the world that are in fact working in the area of geoforensics and have published widely and in fact even books. And it is really important that we link in very carefully with the forensic geologists, because they have huge amounts to offer. In fact, they've been doing a lot of this work prior to the soil scientists ever getting involved. Now the question is, why then don't we call ourselves something else? Why soil scientists? Why forensic soil scientists? And the main reason for that, certainly when we set up our Centre for Forensic Soil Science in Australia, was that CSIRO in their wisdom said, you have to call it soil science. As myself as the director insisted that that is what we'll have to call ourselves. And the main reason for that is really professional experience and credibility. And if we called to be expert witnesses, we can only really talk about our discipline and nothing else. And we're very fortunate in Australia to in fact have professional accreditation. So we, for example, are certified as professional soil scientists. I happen to be a level 3, which is the highest. And effectively, I have a brochure here for those that are interested in this sort of area. Now, the Soil Science Society of America have a very similar accreditation that they, in fact, expanding worldwide. And it's really important to emphasise that. So that when you do go to court and you've got to be an expert witness, I can assure you that in Australia, it's a really great advantage to have that accreditation. Because effectively, when you're being cross-examined, they could spend up to half an hour trying to discredit you, but effectively, if you're certified and it's a professional situation, it invariably gets you through that. But you still have to have experience in your particular field anyway. Now, another good reason for using soil science, the word soil science, is that we link in as soil scientists to a huge area of work internationally. Through, for example, the International Union of Soil Scientists and the Soil Science Society of America, there are a range of working groups that have an enormous amount to offer. For example, there's a group which is a separate commission in the International Union of Soil Sciences, Soils in Urban and Industrial Areas. This is a group of people that have been in existence for almost 15 years that are actually developing tools and methods for mapping urban landscapes. And at the World Congress of Soil Science recently, I interfaced with them quite extensively, and we've set up, as part of that, a forensic, like little subgroup, if you like, working with them. In fact, as part of that same group, there's a group working, and they're very active in the US, Soil Artifact Group, that's actually developing a database of soil artifacts that link into, internationally, the soils of urban industrial areas. There, as an example, there are groups, working groups looking at acid sulfate soils. That's all they do. And effectively, it emphasises how soils change. So if we are involved in a forensic case, it illustrates how quickly soils can change when you expose them to air and so on. And there are, of course, other working groups, soil classification working groups, international and particularly in the USDA. And, of course, in the Soil Science Society of America, you've got wetland soils groups and the soil mineralogy groups. So we have an enormous amount of benefit in, if you like, remaining in a soil discipline that can key into geoforensics and archaeology and so on. And we've got to use these linkages effectively. So what really, where is the sort of origin of forensic soil science? When did it start and how did it start? Now, I'd like to credit the very first person to be Professor Prof. Ehrenberg of Berlin in 1856, because we know this is published and actually did happen. And basically, it's a very simple example of how very simple soil science can be used. And effectively, what happened was it was on a Prussian railroad, a barrel of silver coins went missing when it got to the other side. And when they got to the other side, they found that this barrel was filled with sand. And all Professor Ehrenberg did was he got samples taken from the different railway stations, he used a light microscope, used simple soil morphology, and could identify where that particular sand came from at a particular station. And that was actually published in the Scientific American in 1856. Thanks to our librarian for locating that way back when we set up our centre. Now, a brief history of more recent forensic soil science or forensic soil forensics in Australia. I can only really speak for Australia. Effectively, up until the 1990s, every laboratory in Australia, a forensic laboratory, had a microscope and a specialist that would look at soils. Did he become the sort of soil specialist? And effectively, towards the end of the 1990s, a couple of these people got really destroyed in the courts, the Australian courts, got pretty good barristers down under. And effectively, they stopped doing it because they were more proficient in glass or paint, in soils. They just found that they weren't proficient enough, and the barristers tied them up. And basically, I guess you could argue that during that period of time, a lot of cases in Australia, and we're now dealing with a lot of cold cases, were unaware of how soil information can assist. Basically, it was hidden amongst other trace elements, evidence, often ignored completely. DNA basically took over. And as the previous director, James Robinson, said, it's basically called the flip side, the resource sink away from other areas of forensics. And he also calls it the CSI factor, unrealistic expectations from jurors and judges. Now, I've talked up until now mainly about evidence, the court situation, but a lot of the work that we do in our centre, maybe 20% of the stuff we get, is to do with counterterrorism, in other words, soil information for intelligence only. And in effect, we protect it from those courts by the AFP, in doing that sort of work. And basically, the first case that was done was in the year 2000, in which we did a double murder case, and that really was the beginning of setting the centre up by the forensic scientists of Australia. And a network got together and decided that they needed a specialist soil group to actually look at used soils. So then, how powerful is soil as a contact trace? Now, put the slide up for those that are not forensic people, but effectively, it's in effect governed by what is called the Locop principle, which effectively means when two surfaces come into physical contact, there is a mutual exchange between them. Just come back from a meeting in France, and we were in Lyon. I was very fortunate to be able to have met Edmond Locart's daughter and granddaughter. They had them there specially for us to meet at this Interpol meeting. Now, I believe from a number of the cases that we've done, and from the literature that we've read, soil can almost be considered as approaching an ideal contact trace. And I'll explain why in the next slide. If we can actually identify this in the following six properties. Soil is highly individualistic. And we know from soil maps, from soil types, from experience particularly if you understand natural soils and anthropogenic soils or urban soils, they're pretty highly individualistic. Soils are also very easy to characterise. You saw from that very easy case in 1856, you can use a light microscope. But of course today, we've got things like X-ray diffraction and other gadgets that can actually characterise them pretty quickly and smartly. Soil has a high probability of transfer and retention. So basically mud sticks. And from the work we've done, we'd look at a garment and we'd think there's nothing on it, but when you start looking at it in greater detail, the soil or soil particles occur. It can be quickly collected, separated and concentrated. And of course, this begins the crime scene. That means the crime scene investigators need to know that soil can be of some use. And I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about that in just a moment, which means we need very good collections of controls and alibi sites. I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on that. And soil is almost invisible. And I guess you can sort of compare that to blood and, let's say, lipstick, with bright coloured and it looks different and you can smear it away. So a lot of the baddies these days, because they know DNAs, they can get rid of their blood pretty quickly, and a lot of them do. So the cases we get are those cases where they don't have DNA. And of course, there are computerised soil databases. Lorna gave a talk earlier on showing the Scottish and the British system. We have a system in Australia, the Australian Soil Resource Information Database. It's not perfect because Australia is a pretty big place and we don't have a lot of samples from many places, but what we do have, not too bad. I'm responsible for the Acid Sulphate Soil Atlas, and I have to say in the last 10 years it's tripled almost tenfold in size in terms of adding to the database. But it's far from perfect and it needs to be improved. Now, this is really important to understand, and Lorna emphasised this earlier on. We need to emphasise that soil is a pretty rough way of doing things in forensic science. But in terms of the principles, we need to determine if samples compare or do not compare. If samples do compare, we need to somehow give the degree of probability that the samples may or may not originate from a single place. But we do know, and this is the important part about it, is that no two soil samples, even if I had a sample here and I broke them, put them into two piles, they won't be the same in the theoretical sense. It's the same as if a rock, if you broke a piece of granite in half, those two pieces would effectively be different. So in a theoretical sense, they're basically not the same. Hence, in a sort of absolute sense, you can't really say for 100% certainty they come from a single place. But we do know from that 1856 case and others since then that we can, in fact, establish whether there's a low, moderate, or high degree of probability that a sample was or not derived from a given place. And that's about all we can say, really, is just give a professional judgment as to whether a sample has a high or low degree of comparison. So what we've decided within our centre, having done nearly 79 cases, and they're all in the high category bracket, that we needed to, in fact, publish, or not so much publish, but share the information that we've developed in terms of broad guidelines that we've developed. Up until 6 or 7 months ago, these guidelines have been attached as an appendix to all our forensic reports, soil forensic reports. So what we did, and I thank Lawrence for prompting us to do this as part of the GIN group, was to sort of collate this information and at least give it to people for comment. Now, it's been commented pretty well in a couple of court cases recently, so it's gone through the real hard part of getting a hammering. And effectively, this report, which is about only 25 pages long, it doesn't give all the methods and all the procedures, it just gives effectively the guidelines that we use in our centre to do these cases. And effectively, it's divided into three parts, soil collection and sampling. And basically, we define what is a questioned, a control, and an alibi sample. And then we discuss in a reasonable detail what techniques and methods, and these are all standard methods. We are not talking about new invented methods, standard methods, because they've got to stand up in the courts. And effectively, we've divided that into sort of four stages, and I'll go through those four stages. And then I've included at the back of this some guidelines for expert witness, and that's really important because Luckily in Australia, we do have such guidelines that have gone through the courts to explain how an expert witness should operate in court. And that's included in that. So in terms of collection, I'll do the collection part first, or the sampling. It's important to be able to really look at these things carefully and be able to separate, here's, for example, a shoe from a case we would have done. And effectively you can see from is a grey soil, a dark organic soil here, and in fact a piece of bitumen. You need to sample those separately. And of course, design whatever methods you need eventually when we get to the stage of doing the analysis, how to do this. I'll put this slide up specially because effectively this was in the early days when we set up our centre. You can see filing cabinets, it looks pretty bad. You can see we're not even wearing gloves. Now we have a special laboratory that's been set up just in the last year. It's cost us thousands of dollars and it gets scrutinised by the forensic people, not by soil scientists, forensic people, coming in and actually checking the laboratory that's actually even slightly better than the forensic laboratories because it's in fact quarantined. Forensic laboratories aren't quarantined. So that's in fact because we're bringing in soil samples from all over the world, we need quarantine. And it's a special laboratory built so that at least when we go to court, we can explain the chain of custody much better. And only Mark Raven and I have access to this laboratory. Now I'm going to explain a case, and this is this kidnapping of a 9-year-old child case that we are dealing with. So what normally happens, and I'm just giving you sort of average case, the police arrive with, it's either a shoe or a shovel or something or other, and in this case it happens to be a shoe, and they just said, look, here's the shoe, and can you find any soil on it? Effectively, we think there's soil on it. And we looked at the bottom of the shoe, there's very thin coatings of soil. Here's the top of the shoe, it's got quite a lot of soil on it, enough for us to do pretty well colours and x-ray and so on. So that's a typical example, and we'd call that a questioned sample. And this is where it gets complicated. They give us two soil samples from the shoe imprint area. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of this case because it could take an hour, but effectively, the case is something like this. We get one questioned sample of shoe plus two soil samples, and we do some preliminary work on it to say, yep, we can do the work. I get more information from the police or the detectives, and they tell me that, oh, a bit more about it, that in fact, the person that was actually kidnapped, the young girl that was kidnapped, is there. She was taken to the school by the suspect, raped in two places, which is about almost a kilometre away, and that's where they have the shoe print. And the suspect comes from here, about a kilometre away. Doesn't take us long to look at a soil map to tell us that all these areas here basically have the same soil. Not only that, but if I'm going to go to court, I'm going to need some alibi samples, particularly in this case. I contact the detective again, and of course this is weeks after when this whole thing happened, revisit the site and end up collecting a range of alibi samples, recollecting the soils from the two control sites because they never collected them properly, and we ended up collecting about 9 alibi samples, another 2 control samples, and we selected them based on where they would have believed that the suspect would have walked, or ran rather. So that's sort of a bit of a background to what had happened. Except to say that when the suspect actually left the house, he not only took the young girl when he kidnapped her, but he took the mother's handbag. And that's where everything goes wrong because he tries to use a credit card and gets nabbed and the game is on. They go to the house, they find the shoe, soil on it, and we get involved. So that's how that part of it developed. So just to show you where we collected these samples effectively, this would be, if you like, the crime scene or the a control sample around the tree. This is the other place where these are the two places. We also collected soils along up the pathway as alibi. This is the alibi site. He would have had to have gone down this path, and you can see from just the look of the soil, this is the pathway. This is in the suspect's backyard. This is in his front yard. That's in his backyard. And you can see different colours of soil there for sure. Now, this is where it gets interesting. This is, in fact, at the victim's house. Now, we know he had to have gone through the front door, and he would have had to have gone through the front entrance, and there's a very sandy soil. But interestingly, we took a sample between the road and the house next to a tree as an alibi sample. I'll come back to that later because that's very important. So basically, once we've collected samples, we're pretty happy with them. As part of our forensic guide manual, if you like, we now end up approaching different stages of the analysis. Now, you wonder why we actually are mentioning these different stages. Now, we've learned from some of the court cases we've done that it's very important to be able to explain to whether I'm acting for the defence or whatever lawyers I'm communicating with, what procedures we actually used. And we found it very helpful for them to know that we have a stage one, which basically means we do an initial characterisation, a stage two, which means we do a bit more semi-detailed characterisation, stage three, much more detailed, and then four, we may or may not use soil maps or go out and do work in the field. And it's an easy way of cataloguing effectively what we do. Now, quite often there's a blur between these different stages, and we explain that to them, and we're actually modifying our manual a bit to explain that. But certainly for the lawyers, this is very useful. But let me explain. For the jury, it's even better, because effectively most of these cases, we have to explain this to the jury. They are the ones who count. They're the ones that are going to make the decision. So it's very important to be able to have a system or method that's easy to explain in terms of what we actually do and what methods we use and how they're documented and so on. So effectively, the first method is the screening effectively. We use mostly colour and different soil structures. We then invariably, if it goes to stage two, if we select the samples, we would then actually invariably sieve it. That depends on whether it's from a garment, the question sample is from a garment, because only the fine particles are really going to stick, and I'll use a little example to illustrate that now. And then stage three, if we really are foxed, we'd go to a whole heap of different methods. If need be, we might even hit the synchrotron. And then stage four would involve much more detailed work. Now, we've explained this in a bit of a flow chart, which makes it a bit easier for the legal people to understand and for others. So effectively, a whole soil comes in. Stage one is the initial characterisation, screening of the sample. Stage two, we may or may not sieve it. Invariably, we do, to get it to a similar particle size, so you can comparing apples with apples or oranges with oranges. And we would then look at the mineral and organic composition. And we'd decide on either both or two techniques. Invariably, we use X-ray diffraction and infrared spectroscopy. If we then go to stage three, we might take out the clay fraction, we might take out the heavy mineral fraction, or even the magnetic fraction, and do a whole heap of other tests. And again, if we get to this stage of doing field work, we might use soil classification, mapping, even remote sensing, and so on. Just to fill those gaps in, this is just to show it, the Munsell structure, texture, consistence, and so on. And the technique that we use in deciding on the Munsell structure, whatever it is, are based on standard methods. For example, USDA or the Australian Handbook for Describing Soils. It's really important to emphasise that. And then if it indeed qualifies as having a similar colour and structure, it would then be promoted or selected to go to stage two. We'd then do the sieving and then X-ray it and do all these other methods and so on. So now, for those of you not familiar, this is what a Munsell colour book looks like, how we would determine the colour. We do have gadgets actually to also determine the colours electronically. We need to test those before we take them to the courts. So at the moment, Munsell colour is easy. They can see it. It's easy to explain to the jury. It can take up to 15, 20 minutes to explain a Soil Munster colour book to the jury, and it's important to be able to do that. And of course these other physical descriptions as well, and again, can't overemphasise it, must use standard methods. So let's get to the actual case that I'm using as an example. So this is the kidnapping case. Overall, we collected about 17 samples. That includes question, control and alibi. And as you can see from the chip tray samples, and these are for comparison purposes only, we wouldn't use this in the forensic context, and except that we would collect them as an easy comparison so we can compare them and actually show them. Quite often this is good for the jury. So you can see from this that they're different colours, different structures, and very quickly we could separate, based on colour alone and the structure, we could decide, we eliminated, if you like, seven of the soil samples not being able to compare at all with what was on the shoe. So that then effectively takes us to stage two, which is doing more detailed work. Now in this case, I'll explain why we do the sieving as a quite a good example. This is a case we did some time ago in which we got a shoe. Again, normally it's a Nike with all sorts of lovely areas where soil can get trapped, but only the fine particles get trapped. And this happened to be a case, it was a hit and run. The baddie rushed away, the police saw where he went, jumped through this river, out the other side, and they found him about 6 hours later. Got his shoes, we were given the shoes, told where the site was, and when we looked at the site, it looks pretty gravelly, as you can see here. That would never stick to a shoe. So the obvious thing to do is to sieve it. So what we would do, standard practice within our laboratory, is to take the less than 50 micron. Easy to do, easy to sieve, and effectively, so if we take the less than 50, this is the fine fraction, this is from the shoe, and you can see, just eyeballing it, and if you use the Soil Munster colour, it's almost the same colour. Take it to X-ray diffraction. Mark Raven did this. You can see from, this is the diffraction pattern from the shoe and from the actual site itself. And there's a pretty close comparison in terms of a fingerprinting of X-ray diffraction pattern and, of course, all the minerals. And, of course, this guy was convicted, still sitting in jail. Now, coming to this complicated kidnapping case, it got more complicated because it got more alibi, more samples. So, and I won't go into this in great deal, except to give you the idea that quartz is very invariably the dominant mineral. And of course, in this instance, there's quartz, albite, orthoclase, mica, kaolin, chlorite, amphibole, calcite, dolomite, and hematite in various proportions. Found on these control and, of course, the samples from the soil. And I'll just emphasise here, there are two samples, both from the top of the shoe and from the victim's home, which is outside, that have dolomite. We do a comparison in our cases between, you know, the different shoes, different, and what, how many minerals would compare with what, and it turned out, to cut a long story short, in this instance, the closest comparison happened to be the alibi soil we took outside the person's home because they both contain dolomite. This indicates how careful one has to be in sampling and explaining to the police how important it is to take alibi samples. So here's the shoe. This is outside the victim's house where we believe the suspect or the guy that was eventually convicted stood, and it was a more clay soil, and in fact he managed to get both the clay, the soil, and a bit of the dolomite that happened to be from the road. And when you compare the X-ray diffraction patterns between the two, you can see there's a very close comparison in terms of, if you like, a fingerprinting of the two diffraction patterns. And to cut a long story short, they had no DNA. And they had to rely very heavily on soil evidence, which is sort of the main evidence. And it was a long involved case, but effectively he ended up giving a guilty plea based mainly on our soil evidence and is convicted, pretty serious situation. So that was, and that, again, with a lot of these cases, you see, that was done in 2007. He was only convicted in 2009, and we've only just been given permission to actually talk about it. So they're complicated cases, and we hope to publish this one quite soon as an example of how important it is to have alibi samples. Again, the Munsell colour can be pretty sensitive in terms of colours. I sort of emphasise this, and in terms of diffraction, so colour is a very, very good indicator of what's going on. I've only used up until now the mineralogical comparison, but effectively, many cases when you've got organic matter there or any bitumen, infrared spectroscopy is pretty good. We've got a good team in CSIRO that have done a lot of work on soils and infrared and comparisons, and where they've actually taken a big database of soils and made comparisons in using infrared. Now, we, at this point in time, that's Mark and myself, if we go to court, we're a little bit reluctant at this stage to use these in terms of a court situation because it hasn't really been proven. In terms of intelligence, it's a good tool to be used. Our mind has to be concentrated on the court situation all the time, but it's a very powerful tool, and if you've got organic matter there, this is and only a small amount of sample, that's what you use. Now, up until now, I'm emphasising techniques that are non-destructive. X-ray and FTIR or infrared are non-destructive. They're rapid methods, very little or no sample preparation required. They're non-destructive. This is really important. And you can get a lot of information from a one-minute scan. Now, there are lots of other methods that are used, and we do use them. Now, here's the sort of stage three. Now, we would only use the stage three in really important cases, and quite often it would be where the police or somebody has a lot of money and they've actually said, look, you know, use this money and you can go to town. And effectively, here's an example of where we could even use synchrotron technology and fibres with only small amounts of sample. And again, from more detailed interrogation of X-ray, you can determine a lot more in terms of either using electron microscopy or different patterns that might give us more information about the crystallinity. Thanks, man. And again, just to emphasise, scanning electron microscopy is important and we should use it, where you just cannot use anything else. Here's a case where there was such a little bit of sample, we had no option but to use electron microscopy, and this happened to be a defence case. This is the case where you actually have to use soil maps. This would be a sample, a shovel. Question is, where does this come from? Anywhere in the world. So we'd actually use soil maps to try and this would be, this is a counter-terrorism case, and we would use our soil database, and from this we could develop, if you like, a model or a regular landscape model for the detectives and the police searchers to go and search a particular area. So we built a little model for them that they could use. And again, we wouldn't use soil taxonomy or complicated soil terms. We'd use just simple terms like a yellow-brown soil and explain where that would occur in the topography for them to go and search in a particular area based on information we would have got. And there are other techniques. And this is where the geoforensics people are expert. This is where they come in and we can learn a huge amount from them. Now, I'm going to skip this case, effectively running out of time, but it's really, we're not only doing criminalistic work, but also environmental work. And the same principles apply. We use techniques that are effectively Munsell colour, X-ray, and other techniques. And this was a case in which we solved a case in Australia where the ferns were stolen from a national park. Now, the significance of this work to society, it's obviously saving millions. I believe we've done a little bit of a calculation. We've, in all of the cases, no court hearings, so you can imagine. We certainly are helping the police and forensics people. We think we're saving the world. But I have to say, we've actually completed three cases, or contributed to three cases, in which just having our centre gave an admittance of guilt. So the detectives have actually, and they've written us letters explaining that is what happened. So We gave a quotation to do the work. We never actually did the work. All they did was say, look, we can use soil evidence. This is how we can do it. And the baddies have said, yep, we're sorry, and have admitted guilt. So in terms of conclusions, soil is a powerful contact trace, no doubt about it, and it could be used more, but we've got to be careful in how we use it. Don't oversell it. We've got to explain it carefully. We need to continue to develop and refine these broad guidelines, and I seek help to do that. This is only the beginning, and we want to refine it in terms of the work, and I've sent Lawrence and his team our copies for scrutiny and whatever. Our courts have done a pretty good job on it already. And I believe we should certainly develop and continue to develop these closer linkages, certainly to the soil groups. And I believe as soil scientists, we must continue linkages with the other people, like the geoforensics people, and in particular the archaeologists. They have an enormous amount to contribute, and I don't think we've even explored that area. They really have a lot to with that, I'd like to acknowledge a lot of other people, and thank you very much.
Questions from the floor, please. If you'd just like to raise your hand, I think Marianne has a microphone. Is that microphone working?
Yes.
For the questions?
Could you tell me whether you take a subsample of all other disciplines routinely? Because I've just done a case where a certain geologist, and this is going back a very long time, it's a cold case actually, fractionated the soil to such an extent that I had to reconstitute them, and I got 11 samples out of something like 200 of his subsamples of the original samples, and it was a total nightmare. If the samples had been taken at the same time as he took the samples for the geological side of things, we would have saved an awful lot of money and time and worry. So do you normally take subsamples for other disciplines?
Yes, we do. Yeah, so we would actually, you know, if we have the luxury of actually going out and collecting samples or alibi samples or from the control site or from the crime scene, we would take as much sample as we can. And when we get back to the laboratory, we would, if we take any sub-samples, we would take, we'd keep the original sample intact. That's what I'm really trying to say. And any separations we do, we keep, obviously. But we keep the original sample as intact as we can. And, of course, that's important, particularly when you go to court.
Do you actually take the samples appropriately for the disciplines? Because I know geologists, it's not too much of a worry for them if they go slightly deeper into the soil. But for us, it could be a disaster because pollen declines as you go down the profile. So we would like the top part of the soil, preferably what someone was trodden on. Do you actually take samples of pathologists and diatoms and all that sort of thing?
If we have the luxury of ourselves collecting it, we would collect it as an archaeologist would probably do. But as a, you know, you'd know that if it's only a footprint, you would only take the top, you know, a couple of millimetres, obviously. In fact, that's why we resampled that other site, because the police just took a shovel and took a big sample out. So we went back and resampled it, only the top surface layer. And in our little manual, we've actually explained how samples should be taken. And one of the biggest problems is when samples are taken wet and moist and put into plastic bags. And a lot of cases we've done, they've kept these samples moist or wet, and of course, if you understand simple acid sulfate soil or wet soil pedology, anaerobic conditions take over and these soils become